When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Jeremy Burt was living in his home state of Idaho. After spending time in the Navy and having married a woman he'd met in Japan, he was back in the United States, separated, and looking to build a new future. When he met Kim George, he knew his life was never going to be the same. The two embarked on a whirlwind romance which certainly had its fair share of ups and downs. As things became more serious, they moved in together, and Jeremy realized he needed to finalize his divorce so he could marry Kim. In hopes of doing so as quickly and efficiently as possible, he hired the best divorce lawyer in town, Jeannie Braun. Jeremy and Braun grew close while working together, and at some point, their relationship became more personal than professional. At the same time, Kim had announced she was pregnant, and while Jeremy was elated at the prospect of being a father, he felt he should also still marry Kim, even if his interests might have been split between she and Braun at the time. Over the course of the next few years, his relationship with Kim would collapse, Braun would commit several crimes, and Jeremy would begin tape recording conversations, which later played a role in Braun's conviction. Though not the best at handling his love life, Jeremy was a dedicated father to his new daughter, Mackenzie, and she became the absolute focal point of his life. By February of 2007, Jeremy and Kim were on the mend and giving it another try. They were living together and raising Mackenzie, and everything seemed to be going fine. Then, while Kim was in Las Vegas at a seminar for work, she received a bizarre series of text messages from Jeremy's phone. They claimed he was leaving, going to start a new life, and he wanted nothing to do with her. Just hours earlier, he had left home and told his father he was going to see a friend. He drove off in Kim's car and has never been seen again. During the course of the investigation, authorities would discover a burned-out car, connections to betrayal and corruption, and even a possible link to another missing person whose case remains unsolved. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 57, The Disappearance of Jeremy Burt, Part 1. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, I examine the disappearance of Jeremy Burt, a highly complicated and disturbing case with so many different angles involved. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, transcripts, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. As a final note, I'll be making an appearance at a podcast meetup in Atlanta this October. The meetup will be comprised of other true crime podcasts, including The Fall Line, Moms and Murder, Corpus Delicti, and many more. The event will take place between 2 and 5 p.m. at the Thinking Man Tavern on Saturday, October 13th. For more information, visit trace-evidence.com, and I hope to see you there. As a final note, I wanted to thank all of you for the kindness and support you've given the show. From Patreon donations to amazing reviews and kind words on social media, you make doing this worth it, and it's your passion that helps drive me. Thanks to all of you amazing listeners, Trace Evidence recently passed 3 million downloads. That's a lot of new ears hearing these cases, and I'm grateful to all of you, so thank you. Today I examine the disappearance of Jeremy Burt. This is a case with so many different layers and suspicious characters, it's difficult to keep track of. I originally planned for this to be a single episode, but the further I dug, the more I realized there's far too much to cover here in one sitting. While I'm not big on multi-part episodes, I'm a lot less interested in leaving out important details. This case calls for extra time. This is episode 57, The Disappearance of Jeremy Burt, part 1. Jeremy Carl Burt was born on June 18, 1973, to parents Cheryl and Van Burt. Jeremy was the firstborn child of the Burt family. Later, Cheryl and Van would have two other children, a son named Shane and a daughter named Katrina. Being the eldest, Jeremy often carried the responsibility of looking out for his siblings and to be the dependable, reliable child. This wasn't exactly a challenge for Jeremy, who seemed to have an innate ability and desire to protect those he cared about and to make the right decisions, regardless of how tough they may have been. Friends and family have always described Jeremy as a straight shooter, a stand-up guy, and the type of person you could depend on. These features would stick with Jeremy throughout his life and impact his choices in a myriad of ways. Growing up, the Burt family lived in American Falls, Idaho, located in the southeast corner of the state. American Falls is the county seat of Power County and is what one often imagines as an idyllic image of small-town America, covering just 1.61 square miles and, as of current, a population of just under 4,500 residents. Of course, times were different when Jeremy was a child growing up in the 1970s. American Falls at that time showed a population of just over 2,700. Like many small towns, American Falls had a homegrown feel, one of safety and security, which often resulted in the town folk leaving their doors unlocked and believing that everyone there knew one another. For Jeremy, it was the call of the wilderness that most drew his attention, and he loved being outside, whether it was playing with friends or simply exploring the natural wonders all around him. From a young age, it was clear that Jeremy had an abundance of energy. Whenever the opportunity arose, and even sometimes where it wasn't necessarily appropriate, Jeremy could be found running, playing, and just being rambunctious. While it isn't exactly uncommon for a young boy to have so much energy, as time passed, it seemed apparent that Jeremy struggled most when there was a need for him to be quiet and calm. It didn't take long for Jeremy to receive a diagnosis of ADHD, which seemed to explain all of the extra energy, though now it would be about finding a way to channel that energy. Jeremy found his outlet for this excess of drive in sports and other recreational activities. Jeremy was a decent enough student, but it was in the physical where he excelled the most. It was clear, with each passing year, that Jeremy was going to fill in to be a larger man. He kept growing, getting taller and broader, and with each subsequent inch he gained, it seemed as though his athleticism increased tenfold. The educational system in American Falls was rather small, and so there, Jeremy would attend William Thomas Middle School and later American Falls High School. It was in high school where Jeremy truly hit his stride and began showing his skill and prowess when it came to sports. He was fast and strong, two key assets which made him a valuable member of the American Falls High School football team. In addition to showing his skill on the gridiron, Jeremy also ran track. Despite his growing size, he was able to outrun and overperform many of his more nimble contemporaries. It was clear that Jeremy had talent and poise, and off the field, he continued to use his keen senses of coordination in acts of manual labor, such as carpentry, which he seemed to thoroughly enjoy and excel at. Outside of school and in his leisure time, Jeremy was truly a young man who loved getting his hands dirty. He spent a lot of his time outdoors, and it wasn't long before his love of nature led him deeper and deeper into the wilderness. He quickly acquired a reputation for going off for hours at a time on his own, just exploring the world around him. In addition to that, Jeremy picked up an interest and love for fishing as well as hunting. American Falls offered a wide variety of environments to explore, from dense forestry to marshes, lakes, and ponds. Its eclectic geography actually makes the town a hotspot for bird watching, and the Snake River, as it twists and turns through the landscape, is a popular location for locals to cast a line and spend long summer days fishing and socializing. Socializing was never really an issue for Jeremy, who, by all accounts, had a free-spirited, fun-loving personality. Jeremy has been described as the kind of guy who didn't have a problem making friends, and oftentimes was the center of attention. Being tall, fit, and athletic, his popularity was almost built in, but it was his kindness and sense of humor that really sunk its hooks into those around him. Jeremy possessed an ability to make others feel comfortable, to invite them into his circle. When he spoke to someone, they felt that he was truly listening and giving his attention. There was simply a way about him which could make a perfect stranger feel as though they were the most important thing in his life at that moment. Jeremy's charm, intelligence, and laugh were undeniable, and friends have frequently stated that Jeremy was a great friend and a highly dependable individual. Jeremy may have had a lot of friends, but he kept his inner circle tight, made up predominantly of family. From a young age, his relationship with his cousin, David Burt, was incredibly close and strong. Jeremy often referred to David as his best friend, and they were more like brothers, spending a lot of their free time together, whether it was having fun around town, fishing and hunting, or just sitting around and talking about life. While Jeremy was often a wild bolt of energy, he didn't open up the most vulnerable parts of himself too often. David, though, had a keen insight into his cousin, and the two would frequently get involved in deep conversations, seeking advice and offering guidance. This was a connection which would remain powerful and functional into the final days and even hours before Jeremy would vanish. Following his graduation from high school, Jeremy chose to focus his efforts in an area which had grown close to his heart, the military. With a desire to see the world and also to contribute to his country, Jeremy enlisted in the Navy. His time with the Navy would bring him to many places he never imagined seeing, and also into the heart of war. He would ultimately serve in the Gulf War, undergo SEAL training, and later would be stationed on a destroyer in Japan. It would be his time in Japan that would lead to the first major change in his life. While there, he met and fell in love with a Japanese woman named Rina Suzuki. The two hit it off, and their relationship became so intense that Jeremy asked Rina to return home with him. The two were later married in California, but it wasn't going to be as easy as it all originally seemed. The transition from Japan to the United States was difficult for Rina, and was at the core of budding problems between the newly married couple. Jeremy tried to make Rena feel at home, as they eventually returned to his native Idaho, but it just wasn't working for his young bride. This, coupled with the financial strain of Jeremy exiting the Navy and beginning to do a regular day job, was creating a divide between the two. Ultimately, Rena returned home to Japan, and the couple went their separate ways, though at the time, Jeremy didn't think about getting the paperwork filed for a divorce. While his marriage was recognized in the United States, it was not recognized in Japan, and since Jeremy didn't see another marriage on the horizon anytime soon, it wasn't necessary to go through the legal problems, and perhaps more importantly, the financial problems, to finalize a divorce agreement. Of course, while Jeremy hadn't seen it coming, love has a way of surprising us when we least expect it. Shortly after his separation from Rena, Jeremy met and quickly fell in love with Kim George. Kim was a few years younger than Jeremy, but he was quickly enamored by the beautiful young blonde. Jeremy's cousin, David, would later say, quote, "Jeremy fell for her hook and line. Beautiful and smart and funny, Jeremy and her really clicked," end quote. For Kim, the feeling was very much mutual, and she was absolutely head over heels for Jeremy. She saw a future for them together, and it was a feeling she found difficult to completely put into words, though she later said, quote, "We met when I was 22. He was tall, handsome, and funny and outgoing, and just very social. I think I knew in my heart that he was the one I was going to be with for a long time," end quote. Of course, while the relationship between the two was quickly growing stronger, it was clear to many around them that their passionate personalities could often lead to disagreements and moments of frustration. Both were driven, determined, and focused. For many, they described the relationship as amazing when things were clicking and explosive when they weren't. Jeremy's sister, Katrina, would later describe it by saying, quote, "Jeremy and Kim have always had a love-hate relationship. They love each other while they're hating each other," end quote. The relationship was described as having its ebbs and flows, with the two being very soft-spoken and loving one minute, and then shouting and arguing the next. It was an interesting dynamic, to see these two people who clearly cared so deeply about one another, but they could never seem to quite get their footing and talk things through without their voices rising. Despite their issues, it was also obvious to everyone how much they loved one another. While they might want to kill each other some days, there were also no other people in the world they wanted to spend their time with. At first, the couple moved in together, living in Pocatello, Idaho. Drastically different from American Falls, Pocatello offered more options and a more vibrant and busy lifestyle. Kim, at the time, was finishing up college and Jeremy was working construction. He had skills when it came to carpentry and he turned those into a business model, working mostly in the field of roofing, though he could do it all. The job consisted of brutally hot days, long hours, and physical challenges, but that was right up Jeremy's alley. He liked working with his hands, seeing what he could do on his own, and working for himself. He was able to set his own schedule and to have more freedom in his comings and goings. Unfortunately, the construction business also has its downsides. While jobs could be highly lucrative, it was a struggle to find work sometimes. When his schedule was locked down, Jeremy would have cash flowing in, but when the season slowed down, money could be tight. Despite making large sums of money, nearly everyone in Jeremy's life has explained that he never had a great sense of budgeting. Money would simply burn a hole in his pocket, and it wasn't uncommon for him to earn upwards of $200,000 in a year, but to be struggling to make ends meet just a few months later. In order to try and keep things more consistent, and to explore a bit more of what a larger city had to offer, Kim and Jeremy decided around the year 2000 to move to Boise, the state capital. Living in Boise began very well. Jeremy and Kim purchased a home and set down roots. Jeremy's business began booming as Boise was in the midst of tremendous growth, and new houses and apartment complexes were going up every day. Between 1990 and 2000, the population exploded from 125,000 to over 185,000, and today it sits at just over 225,000. It was clear to Jeremy that this was a city where they could build a life, and financially, there should never be a dramatic lack of opportunities for him to ply his craft and support Kim, and he hoped, a family. Jeremy had always wanted children, and in early 2002, that dream seemed as though it was going to come true. Kim told Jeremy she was pregnant, and his excitement was undeniable. Kim later said, quote, "Jeremy had always wanted kids. He was so excited. It was like Christmas 10 times over for him." End quote. While Jeremy was eager to be a father and was exceedingly amped up about the opportunity, he realized there was something else he needed to take care of first. Jeremy wanted to marry Kim before they had a child, but he'd still never gone through with filing the paperwork to officially end his marriage. After discussing this with Kim, the couple sat down together and began looking through the yellow pages for a local divorce attorney. They would ultimately settle on a lawyer named Jeannie Braun, a woman with a reputation that preceded her. She was thought of as one of the best, most efficient, and intelligent divorce lawyers in the entire state, and wanting to get things taken care of as quickly as possible and with as little difficulty as needed, Jeremy made the decision to meet with Braun. Following their consultation, Jeremy was quick to hire on Braun and begin the process of freeing himself from his former marriage so that he could embark upon his new life with Kim and their unborn child. Life, however, is never without its challenges and complications. Jeremy's divorce arrangements required him to meet with Braun many times to discuss different angles and to give background and information. It was during these meetings that the two became more friendly, and talk slowly began moving away from the divorce and onto life in general. They found they shared a lot in common, with Braun having formerly been in the military herself. Jeremy's father, Van, at first thought well of Braun, but he also saw indicators that there might be more going on than just legal counsel. Van later said, quote, "She was one of the best divorce lawyers in the state, and from my understanding, they became really close." End quote. Their professional relationship began changing into a more personal one, and Kim couldn't help but get suspicious of all the time the two were spending together. Sadly, not long after Jeremy had been pursuing a divorce, tragedy struck when Kim suffered a miscarriage. Both she and Jeremy were devastated, and from that moment on, it seemed possible that Jeremy may have made the choice to go a different way. His brother, Shane, would later say, quote, "He was extremely disappointed. Knowing how passionate and how good of a father he is, I don't know if something changed with him." End quote. The pain and grief experienced by both Jeremy and Kim, some believe, may have pushed Jeremy closer to Braun. Jeremy's mother, Cheryl, later said, quote, "I think this woman preys on men. She knew Jeremy was vulnerable, and she preyed on him." End quote. Regardless of Jeremy's grief and vulnerability, he was a smart and independent man who wasn't likely to enter any relationship if he didn't want to. His relationship with Braun continued developing and began heading down a more romantic path. He maintained his living arrangements and relationship with Kim despite this. Following the miscarriage, the two had decided to go forward with the wedding and to try and have a child again. All the while, as they were building this future together, Jeremy was working closely with Braun to lock in the divorce. Kim, at first, thought that it was all in her head. She knew Jeremy had to work closely with Braun for the divorce, but as time progressed, she began seeing signs indicating that more was going on. Approximately 6 months after the miscarriage, she had gotten pregnant again, and while Jeremy was excited and happy, she could tell something was off. Braun had managed to finalize the divorce, and while Jeremy was a free man and no longer needed to see her, their relationship was far from over. Jeremy and Kim's wedding was scheduled for August 24th, 2002, but in the weeks leading up to it, both Kim and Jeremy seemed to have been having second thoughts. While Jeremy loved Kim and was excited about being a father, there was something about Braun which he couldn't quite remove himself from. His cousin David later explained, quote, "He told me about the relationship with Jeannie Braun pretty much from when it started. Jeremy always loved women that were really well put together. Jeremy was infatuated with Jeannie, to an extent." End quote. It seemed that the 29-year-old man was unsure that he was ready to commit himself to marriage again. Things weren't made any easier by the influence of his smart, beautiful, and financially well-to-do divorce lawyer. Kim noticed that things weren't right, though she wasn't at the time prepared to face the difficult truth. In a later interview, Kim explained, quote, "Right before we got married, it started to turn more romantic. She was taking him out to eat, buying him gifts, I mean expensive $500 watches. I didn't know for sure, but in my heart, I knew. He changed." End quote. Despite Kim's suspicion and Jeremy's hesitance, the two went forward with the marriage. Kim wanted to believe that Jeremy loved her, and that while Braun was coming on to him, nothing was going on. Jeremy, on the other hand, did in fact love Kim, but he viewed the wedding more as his responsibility than something he wanted to do. Kim was pregnant with their daughter, and in his mind, it was his duty to go through with the marriage and to do whatever he could to support his family. Of course, Jeremy wasn't exactly sure about the direction he wanted to take, but more so, it seemed like the one he had to take. His brother Shane spoke to Jeremy after the wedding, and later said, quote, "I remember Jeremy telling me afterwards he wasn't sure if he wanted to get married or not. He just felt like that was what he should do." End quote. The marriage was obviously not built on very solid foundations, and the issues between Jeremy and Kim were quick to rise to the surface. During the course of their marriage, the one truly bright spot came on March 3rd, 2003, when their daughter Mackenzie was born. It was immediately clear to everyone from that day forward, Jeremy's entire life would revolve around his little girl. Jeremy was completely head over heels for Mackenzie, and his dedication to her would rival everything else in his life. Unfortunately for the newlyweds, things weren't connecting strongly enough for them anymore, and within the first year of their marriage, Kim and Jeremy were divorced. Complications arising from finances, irreconcilable differences, and Jeremy's personal relationship with Braun were all factors in the collapse. Kim had come to terms with the fact that things between Jeremy and Braun were much more than she had initially thought, and she later explained, saying, quote, "I officially admitted to myself that he was having an affair with her, and I made him move out of the house." End quote. While this was a situation which could easily have turned bitter and angry, both Jeremy and Kim were willing to put aside their differences for Mackenzie's sake. It was their daughter who would keep them close, and even during their separation following the divorce, they maintained a friendship. During this time, Jeremy was as devoted a father as a man could be. He spent every free moment he had with Mackenzie. Kim, when asked about the relationship between Jeremy and Mackenzie, responded by saying, quote, "He was an amazing father. He loved her more than anything. He could not handle being away from her for even a day. It was a close bond that you could just see when you saw them together. And if anyone asked him what the most important thing in his world was, he would say Mackenzie." End quote. While Jeremy was being the best father he could be, his relationship with Braun took a dramatic and shocking turn, which seemed to, if nothing else, shake him from his infatuation and allow him to see things more clearly. Not long after the birth of Mackenzie, Jeannie Braun was arrested. The charges included forgery, intimidation of a witness, and destruction of evidence. In regard to the forgery charge, it's been reported that Braun had forged a judge's signature in a child custody case. A powerful, smart, and savvy lawyer, much of her legal past activities would be called into question. Braun initially pleaded not guilty, but according to friends and family, Jeremy told them that she had told him in private that she was guilty. It's been alleged that Jeremy learned of Braun's guilt when she tried to get him involved in a plot to frame her assistant, Shannon, for the forgery. Jeremy knew Shannon through his connection to Braun. He'd actually attended her wedding. Braun and Jeremy had gone on a double date to the wedding alongside Constance Malman Norris and her then-boyfriend, Aaron Bernard. Remember Aaron Bernard's name, as it's going to become important later. Jeremy took it upon himself to prove that Braun had committed the crimes. In response to the revelation about her true intentions, he went to Kim and admitted everything to her. He told her about the relationship, how he had cheated on her, and the illegal activities that Braun was a part of. It was also at this time that he told Kim he planned to continue meeting with Braun, but that he was going to tape record their conversations in an attempt to get her to admit her guilt. During this time, it seems that Braun was unaware of Jeremy's activities and attempts to prove her guilt. The two continued seeing one another, but when Jeremy was called as a witness to testify before a grand jury in 2004 in regard to Braun's charges, she started trying to convince him not to testify. A restraining order was ultimately granted, and Braun was told to stay away from Jeremy, but she refused to do so. Ultimately, Jeremy got her on tape not only confessing to the crime she had committed, but also attempting to bribe him out of testifying. Each time Jeremy met with Braun, he would later tell Kim about the events of the day and play some of the recordings for her. He was trying hard to show Kim that he had changed, that she could trust him, and that he was deeply sorry for betraying her. Kim later explained, quote, "He told me everything and was very candid, so I knew a lot of what was going on," end quote. Jeremy's recordings and testimony played a key role in Braun's prosecution and met with overwhelming evidence. On Thursday, May 19th, 2005, Braun changed her stance and pleaded guilty to forgery, and in turn the other charges against her were dropped. As a result of her plea, Braun was officially disbarred, losing her license to practice law, and sentenced to a year in prison to be followed up by 14 years probation. It seemed that this would, at a minimum, grant necessary space between Jeremy and Braun. Even though he had testified against her and been disgusted by her illegal actions, some friends have suggested that Jeremy still had feelings for her and was hopeful that this time apart would allow him to move on. David later said, quote, "I think he missed Jeannie for a while there. He really cared about her," end quote. But Jeremy also hoped to refocus his attention and time on Kim. He still loved her, and they shared a daughter together. Jeremy very much wanted to provide his daughter with a strong family, and while they were not together as a couple, he and Kim started becoming closer again. A fascinating angle about the recordings that Jeremy kept was that he wasn't just recording Braun. Jeremy had gotten into the habit of recording a lot of conversations, some over the phone and some in person. It is known that around this time, he was also recording conversations he was having with Kim. It's been speculated that he may have been doing this to gather evidence in case things ever went negatively between the two of them and led to a custody battle. The utter irony is that it's been stated that it was in fact Braun who advised him to do this, not knowing that her own advice would later turn around and cause her to be cornered in her own legal problem. Over the course of the next year, Kim and Jeremy's relationship was slowly repaired. The two worked hard to maintain a closeness and to foster a loving and united environment for Mackenzie. After their divorce, Jeremy had moved in with his father, who worked with him. They had worked on a new apartment complex together, and when it was completed, they moved into one of the spaces located at 2253 South Hervey Street. Whether it was the result of an attempt to rekindle their flame, a way to be closer to Mackenzie, or simply done out of financial ease, Jeremy asked Kim if she wanted to move in, and she agreed. In June of 2006, Kim officially moved in with Jeremy and Van, and things were going well. Their relationship was stronger, and those old feelings were stirring back up again. Kim was excited, and later explained, quote, "Jeremy and my relationship was going so well. I was looking at getting my wedding ring back," end quote. Interestingly, Jeremy's laptop would show that, even through this time, he was still recording their conversations. Soon, Braun would add another complication to their newly formed relationship. A year had passed, and she was being released from prison. Jeremy thought that she might try to see him again, and so he warned Kim that this was a possibility. Kim asked Jeremy if he was still interested in Braun, and he denied it, but some believe that wasn't the entire truth. Jeremy's father, Van, had witnessed Braun's persistence, explaining, quote, "I don't think it was very long after she'd gotten out of jail, she and Jeremy were seeing each other again. She would even bring lunch out to Jeremy and I as we were working on roofing," end quote. What exactly was going on between them at this time is unknown, whether it was just friendly or if there was something more romantic, but by all accounts, Jeremy was trying to resist the temptation that Braun presented. He was also suspicious, and at one point had a conversation with his cousin David, explaining that Braun had reached out to him when she was released. She wanted to continue their relationship, but David advised Jeremy not to trust her. He was a big reason why she'd been in prison and lost her license to practice law. There was no way she could have good intentions. Opinions vary about what exactly happened at this time. Many have said that Jeremy may have had feelings for Braun, but whether or not he was conflicted, he made the choice to devote himself entirely to Kim, and at this point, he told Braun to stay away from him. What they had meant something, but it was over, and he was moving on with his life. Braun, though, wasn't ready to give up so easily, and continued making appearances. On one particular occasion, Kim called Jeremy to tell him that she was on her way home, and there was a knock at the door. In the background, she heard a female voice. Braun had showed up at the apartment, wanting to see Jeremy. According to Van, Jeremy got angry and told her to leave and not to come back. He told her that Kim was going to be home soon, and if she saw Braun, it would cause a problem. It was later said that Jeremy screamed at Braun and told her to get out of the apartment complex. Meanwhile, Braun responded by saying she meant no harm and just wanted to see him. When Kim arrived home later and asked what happened, Jeremy didn't hide any details and told her the whole story. Kim was angry. She felt like this woman who had caused problems in their previous relationship was going to keep popping up and trying to win Jeremy back. In response to the unwelcome visit, she placed a call to Braun's parole officer and explained that Braun was arriving without invitation and that she shouldn't be trying to see Jeremy regardless, since he had testified against her before the grand jury. According to Braun, this severed her relationship with Jeremy going forward, and she didn't attempt to see or communicate with him again. But this statement is very much a point of contention for those who will later examine Jeremy's disappearance. There are, however, differing opinions which have suggested that Jeremy may have initially pumped the brakes on Braun's return into his life, but ultimately had once again engaged in an affair with her. The truth is, no one can say one way or another with 100% certainty, at least no one in Jeremy's circle. Braun may be able to offer insight into this, but the value of her opinion in regard to her relationship with Jeremy, and ultimately what may have happened to him, has been called into question a great deal. By February of 2007, Braun appeared to be gone from their lives. Kim and Jeremy were back together and doing well. Their relationship was developing, and neither was in too much of a rush to force things, but they were happy. Friends and family have all reported that Jeremy was excited about the prospect of building a new future with Kim, and he had put the mistakes of the past behind him. On Friday, February 9th, Jeremy decided to pay a visit to his mother and sister in American Falls. He packed up some things and brought Mackenzie with him to visit her grandmother and aunt. That night, he left Mackenzie with his mother and went out to play cards with his cousin David. According to David, everything seemed to be going well, and Jeremy didn't display any outward signs of unhappiness, and he certainly didn't mention any plans to go anywhere. The following night, on Saturday, February 10th, Jeremy again spent time with David. This time, they went to a local bar that they had often frequented in the past in Pocatello. There, they met up with some old friends and planned to spend the night having drinks and shooting pool. Nothing seemed to be out of the ordinary, but towards the end of the evening, Jeremy approached David and told him that he needed to talk. He asked David to leave the bar so they could go someplace more private, but David was waiting on a date and didn't want to go. He told Jeremy that they could talk the next day, and Jeremy agreed and ended up leaving the bar alone that night. David would later say, quote, "The next day, he tried to call me on my cell phone, but I didn't answer. It was the morning time, and that was it." End quote. David will never speak to Jeremy again. Jeremy went home and spent the night at his mother's place, but the next morning, on Sunday, he was packing up and ready to go early in the morning. According to Jeremy's sister Katrina, their mother wanted him to stick around longer, but he had work to get to that week, and he wanted to get home before it was late. Katrina had worked the night shift and was trying to get sleep that morning, but the conversation between Jeremy and their mother had disrupted her sleep. Katrina later said, quote, "I was laying in my bed, and when he came to get his stuff, and I heard him come through the door, and I heard my mother say, 'Oh, you're leaving already?' Mom was trying to talk him into staying, and I heard him say, 'No, we gotta go, we gotta go.' I remember thinking to myself, should I get up and go give him a hug, or should I just lay here? And I was like, 'Oh well, I'll see him again.'" End quote. Neither Katrina nor Cheryl had any clue or indication that they would never see Jeremy again. On Sunday, February 11th, Jeremy and Mackenzie began the drive back to Boise. The trip covers approximately 200 miles, and Jeremy would drive along I-86 West, which travels through very sparsely populated areas. While Jeremy is driving, Kim is back at the apartment with Van, and she's packing up for a trip to Las Vegas. The trip isn't for pleasure, and is part of a week-long training seminar that Kim has to attend for work. By the time Jeremy makes it home, he just missed Kim, who was heading off to the airport. Jeremy and Van talk for a while about the weekend, work plans, and then the phone rang. It was Kim, calling to tell Jeremy that she'd made it to Vegas. It was later in the evening when this call took place, approximately 10 p.m. Jeremy's mother, Cheryl, beeped into the call at approximately 10:10 to check and make sure that Jeremy made it home safely. Jeremy told her the trip was fine and that he was on the phone with Kim and he'd talk to her later. Cheryl told Jeremy that she loved him and said goodbye. This would be the last time Cheryl would ever speak to her son. After switching back to the call with Kim, she tried to convince him to come up to Vegas. According to Kim, she told Jeremy to hop in her car, a Mercury Cougar, and drive on up. Valentine's Day was just 3 days away, and while she was busy during the days with her training, they'd have the nights free to have some fun together. The drive from Boise to Vegas is approximately 10 hours, and while Jeremy was excited by the idea, he told Kim that he had work to do the next day and he couldn't just up and leave. Kim understood, and the two talked for a few more minutes before saying goodnight. After the call, the evening seemed normal. It should be noted that this accounting of events has been told by Kim. Others have suggested that things were the other way around, that Jeremy wanted to come to Vegas to see her, and it was her decision for him not to come. According to Van, Jeremy got off the phone and went on his computer for a while and seemed to be relaxing for the evening, but then something changed. He took a shower and got dressed up. He told Van that he was going to go visit his friend, Greg Reno. Elk hunting season was coming up, and they were going to discuss some possible hunting trips. Just a few months earlier, Jeremy had acquired a new hunting bow. The bow was his most prized possession, and he was excited and eager to test it out this season. According to Van, Jeremy asked if he wouldn't mind watching Mackenzie so that he could go out. Van agreed, and at this time, Jeremy left the apartment, got into Kim's Mercury Cougar, and drove off. This is the last confirmed sighting of Jeremy Burt, and it took place between 10:20 and 10:30 p.m. Where Jeremy went that night remains unknown, but when Van awoke the next morning on Monday, February 12th, he found that his son hadn't come home. He didn't initially think anything of it. It wasn't completely uncommon for Jeremy to spend the night at a friend's house if he had a few drinks too many. Van assumed that, while Jeremy had planned to meet Greg, he likely was also planning to hit the town. When he'd left the house, he hadn't changed into relaxing clothing as though he was just going to hang out with Greg for a while. Van later said, quote, "When I think about the way he dressed, he had on a turtleneck with a dark-colored shirt. He was not dressed to go talk with his friend, but to go out and do a little partying." End quote. As the day began turning into night, Van began getting a little worried. It wasn't completely uncommon for Jeremy to go off on his own for a few days, hiking or hunting spontaneously. In fact, Jeremy had gone off before without warning, but it wasn't typical for him to do this while he was in custody of Mackenzie. At the time, no one was aware that anything might be wrong, and only Van knew that Jeremy hadn't come home. Later, on Monday night, as Kim was finishing up her first full day of training, she returned to her hotel room and her cell phone rang. When she looked down at the screen, the call was from Jeremy. Kim answered, but no one was there. She later explained, quote, "I picked up the phone and said, 'Hey babe,' and it hung up. I thought, oh, must have lost connection or something. I called him back and it went straight to his voicemail, and I never got a call back from him." End quote. Kim wasn't immediately worried. There were large areas where cell reception was bad, and she simply assumed that Jeremy was driving and would call her back when he had signal again. Unfortunately, that call would never come. The next afternoon, on Tuesday, February 13th, while in the midst of her training, at approximately 2 p.m., Kim received a text message from Jeremy's number. The message read only, "We need to talk." Being that she was in the middle of her seminar, she couldn't answer back right away, but she started getting concerned, hoping everything was okay. Kim wasn't able to respond until approximately 5 p.m. when the seminar ended, but when she went to do so, she was shocked to see 17 unanswered text messages from Jeremy. The first text immediately sent her into a tailspin and read, quote, "Goodbye, Kim. Good luck with your life. I'll come get Mackenzie later. Don't contact me. I'm leaving." End quote. The rest of the text seemed to comprise a lot of statements about leaving, not wanting to try and work things out, being unhappy, and all manner of statements that, given the circumstances, didn't make any sense. Things were going great between them, and she'd just spoken to him Sunday night, and he seemed happy. The more Kim read, though, the more suspicious she began to get. First and foremost, Jeremy wasn't much for texting. He was much more the type of person who picked up the phone and called rather than send a text message. He preferred to handle things in a more personal way. On top of that, it didn't make any sense that he would be leaving to go somewhere else. His daughter, family, business, and friends were all in the area, and it was highly unlikely that he would just up and leave without them. Some of the texts had Jeremy saying that he was planning to go someplace new, to start a new life, and to do it under a new identity. It simply didn't make any sense. Kim began texting back. There was a bit of a back and forth, but bizarrely, Jeremy wouldn't answer his phone. Kim kept calling every few minutes, but the phone would go straight to voicemail. Frustrated and hurt, Kim was crying and trying to figure out what was happening, but she couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. She called again, and according to Kim, quote, "Finally, the phone answered, and I was just like, 'Jeremy, please don't do this.' I heard a big sigh, and click, it hung up." End quote. After this call, Kim began wondering if it was even Jeremy using his phone. She sent a final text which read, "Is this even you?" There was no response. This emotional moment gave Kim flashbacks to when she and Jeremy had divorced. She knew that Braun was out of jail and had been trying to reestablish contact with him, so she began to wonder if it was possible that something had happened between the two of them and if Jeremy was planning to run off with her. The problem was, she couldn't figure out how that would have happened. The more she thought about it, the less she could find which would connect anything to Braun. Kim later explained, quote, "He was home all the time. He never left to go anywhere randomly. I knew when something was going on. I'd been with him for 10 years at this point, and I'd gone through an affair." End quote. Upset and scared, Kim decided to call Van and ask him if he knew what was going on. To her surprise, he was just as confused. Van explained that he hadn't seen Jeremy since Sunday night, and that he thought he may have gone hunting, but the text messages didn't make any sense, and he hadn't heard Jeremy say anything about leaving Kim. Van later stated, quote, "When Kim told me about the text messages, I thought, no way. I don't know how many times he ever text messaged anyone. If he had something to say to you, he said it and he meant it." End quote. After speaking with Van, the next person Kim could think to call was David. If anyone in Jeremy's life might have had insight into what was going on with him, it would certainly be his cousin and best friend. Kim knew that Jeremy spent time with David over the weekend, and so she began asking him if anything was wrong, if Jeremy talked about leaving, if he said anything that might explain things. David was just as confused as both Kim and Van, and expressed that Jeremy gave him no indication that anything was wrong at all. In fact, Jeremy seemed happy. Then David remembered that Jeremy had wanted to speak to him on Saturday night, but they never did. To this day, David regrets not leaving with Jeremy, and he can't help but wonder if he had done so and spoken to his cousin, if he might still be around today. Kim read the text messages to David, but he couldn't make sense of them. On the one hand, they didn't sound like Jeremy, the language wasn't right, and again, it wasn't Jeremy's usual style to send text messages. There was, though, one statement in the texts which struck everyone. Referring to Mackenzie, one of the tests said to ask her, "How'd she get so cute?" This was a very personal expression between Jeremy and his daughter. He would often ask her how she got so cute, and she would respond by saying she got so cute because she's her daddy's girl. This one statement makes it possible that it may have been Jeremy sending the texts, but they couldn't help but wonder if it might not just be someone who knew Jeremy very well. Ultimately, everyone who read the texts believes that they were a conscious attempt to make it seem like they were being sent by Jeremy, but no one believes that they were actually typed by Jeremy. Over the course of the next 24 hours, Van continued looking for Mackenzie, but also began driving around town looking for Jeremy. Family members were slowly notified, and each initiated calls to Jeremy's phone, which sent them straight to voicemail. Numerous messages were left, including one from Jeremy's brother Shane, at which time he broke down emotionally, telling his brother that they were all worried about him and needed to know where he was. Family members pled with Jeremy on his voicemail, begging him to at least reach out to someone to let them know that he was all right. Jeremy never did, though, and his phone was never answered, though it did appear to still be powered on. Kim was an emotional wreck in Las Vegas, trying to push through her seminar so that she could get home and look for Jeremy. She still wasn't sure if this was all part of some elaborate ruse indicating foul play, or if Jeremy had truly left her. It was an emotional roller coaster, and she couldn't find her footing. On Friday, February 16th, David called Kim to tell her what was going on. The situation remained the same. No one could find Jeremy, and he wasn't answering his phone. At this time, David asked Kim to file a missing persons report with the Boise Police Department. Kim wouldn't be arriving home until the next day, and based upon what she experienced when she arrived, she figured she'd determine whether or not to file the report, if Jeremy was actually missing, or if he had left of his own volition. Why everyone was waiting for Kim to file the report is unknown. Family members may not have believed that Jeremy was actually missing, and again, for many people in Jeremy's life, it wasn't completely uncommon for him to go off on his own. Either way, Kim arrived back in Boise on Saturday, February 17th. As soon as she got to the apartment, she realized something was very wrong. Not only had Jeremy disappeared, but he'd taken her car to do so. That didn't make any sense to her, but at the time, Jeremy had no other mode of transportation. He'd gotten into the habit of taking out loans and using his truck as collateral during the lean times at work. At this particular time, he'd fallen behind on his payments, and his truck had actually been repossessed. It should be noted there are some discrepancies in this timeline. While Kim herself has said she didn't arrive home until the 17th, at which time she filed the report, others have suggested she came home on Monday and filed the report then. It's hard to know for certain who's telling the truth on this, but I have seen a number of reports about Jeremy missing which are dated February 17th. Though her missing car was a disturbing detail, it's actually the items left behind which made Kim panic the most. Jeremy didn't appear to have taken anything with him. Left behind in the apartment were his computer, all of his clothing, his hunting and camping supplies, and his new, prized bow. If Jeremy were planning to go off somewhere to start a new life, why wouldn't he have brought anything with him? Kim called the Boise Police Department to file a missing persons report, but there was a problem. The text messages sent from Jeremy's phone indicated that he was planning to leave, and while it may be disturbing for those who know and love him, the police informed Kim that Jeremy was an adult, and if he wanted to leave of his own volition, there's really nothing they could do about it. In order to attempt to expedite the process and to get police moving, Kim explains that Jeremy had taken her car without her permission, and so she filed a report for a stolen car. Police put out notices about the vehicle, giving its make, model, and description, but launched no investigation into Jeremy's disappearance itself. A detective was assigned to the case, but didn't launch a major investigation. Though details about this have yet again been the subject of contradiction, it seems that, at this early stage, some efforts were made to try and locate the vehicle. Jeremy's phone records were examined and his bank account was checked, but at that time, nothing extensive was conducted. It appears that there wasn't even an attempt to ping Jeremy's phone to garner a possible location. Eager for information and to push harder for the police to try and locate Jeremy, several members of his family, including his mother and brother, came to Boise. They came together at the police department, at which time they were led into a room and given time to speak with a detective. According to the family, the detective directly asked them if this seemed like the kind of behavior Jeremy would normally conduct. They agreed that he had gone off on his own to go hunting or fishing in the past, but he'd always told them where he was going, and he never left all of his possessions behind. If he was just off on a hike or hunting, he hadn't brought anything with him like he normally would. In addition to this, Mackenzie was the most important person in his life, and there was no way he would ever walk away from her without an explanation. The family found it odd that the only person he'd allegedly attempted to contact in any way was Kim, via text message, and they once again expressed that Jeremy was not the texting type. When asked about financial problems, the family were quick to explain that Jeremy was never great at handling money, and working on construction was often a case of feast or famine. They told the detective about his truck recently being repossessed, but also added that Jeremy oftentimes took out loans using his truck as collateral when times were tight. The detective asked the family if there were any people in Jeremy's life that they felt could have had bad intentions towards him, and they gave him several names. These names have never been revealed publicly, though many have speculated that among the names was Jeannie Braun. The family left the meeting feeling frustrated that things weren't moving faster, though without any evidence of foul play, police had very little to go on. Jeff Wodarki, a detective working for the Boise Police Department, had a struggle on his hands. While the family were sure that something bad had happened, there simply wasn't enough information to pursue it as a crime. Wodarki explained, quote, "Jeremy was known to take off for a couple of weeks at a time. He was self-employed, so he had some flexibility in his schedule, and he loved the outdoors. Financially, Jeremy had some problems. One of the theories was that he just packed up and left to get away from his past." End quote. Over the course of the next few weeks, the family continued fighting to get Jeremy's case officially classified as a missing persons. They printed up flyers, which they posted all around Boise and other towns. They hoped to turn up information on a local level, believing that someone must have seen Jeremy sometime after he left his home on the 11th. While some calls came in, these failed to lead to anything solid. They tried to maintain hope, but when March 3rd rolled around, Mackenzie's 4th birthday, and no one heard from Jeremy, they all knew something terrible had happened. Cheryl later stated, quote, "About a month after Jeremy went missing was Mackenzie's birthday, and nobody heard from him. It just reaffirmed in my mind that this was not right. He wouldn't have gone past Mackenzie's birthday without calling or talking to her or something, somehow, some way." End quote. For Wodarki and the police, there was very little they could do in terms of an investigation. Kim's car hadn't been seen since Jeremy disappeared, and so, hoping to gain more insight, they began interviewing friends and family members, hoping to find someone who may have some knowledge about Jeremy's plans or whereabouts. Unfortunately, no one seemed to be in possession of any knowledge which could help them. One of the first people they spoke to was Greg Reno, Jeremy's friend who he had told his father he was going to see the night he disappeared. It was a fairly short interview, as Greg informed the authorities that he hadn't seen Jeremy that night. According to him, he'd gone to bed without knowing Jeremy had planned to come by at all. When he woke up the following day, he saw that he'd missed a call from Jeremy from the night he vanished. He called back, but never received an answer. With nothing to go on, no major leads, and frankly at the time, no crime to investigate, the police were fairly inactive. For Jeremy's family, as the week continued passing, they kept trying to stir up local awareness, but the further you get from the event, the less people are engaged. Soon, months began passing, and Jeremy remained a complete mystery. His phone still went straight to voicemail, there were no sightings, no attempts at contact, and no answers about where he could have been or what may have happened to him. Cheryl, when asked about this time, responded, quote, "When you have a death in your family, at least you know what happened. You know where they are. But not knowing what's happened, I just kept thinking, why haven't they found the car?" End quote. In what many have referred to as a strange turn of events, to say the least, approximately 3 weeks to a month after Jeremy disappeared, Kim made a major change in her life. She got married. With Jeremy gone less than 60 days, Kim married a man from American Falls, Jeremy's hometown. And in fact, it was a man that Jeremy knew and was friendly with. This has led to a lot of questions about Kim and Jeremy's relationship. There's been a great deal of speculation about Kim possibly having an affair behind Jeremy's back, like he had done with Braun, while others believe that Kim turned to this friend in her grief and frustration, and things just quickly came together. It's hard to argue much because, no matter what way you slice it, that's a remarkably fast turnaround. Jeremy's family couldn't help but wonder, what if Jeremy came back the next day? How would Kim explain being married that quickly? It set off a lot of suspicion, and it wasn't long after that that the case really began to heat up. On Friday, May 18th, a man was out riding horseback, driving cattle through the Bruno Desert, located approximately 100 miles south of Boise. The barren area can be a treacherous ride, over sand dunes, sharp ridges, and through a myriad of ditches. While working, the man noticed something strange. Half a mile off a dirt track, over bumpy, difficult-to-navigate terrain, he saw what appeared to be the torched remains of a car. The fire had burned with such intensity that it had melted away almost every part of the vehicle, other than the frame and a few small portions of painted exterior. When he reached a phone, the man placed a call to the sheriff's department, and they dispatched deputies to examine the scene. There wasn't much to see, mostly ashes and scorched metal. The license plates were missing, and at first, deputies figured the car had been torched and hidden there for an insurance scam. Upon approaching the vehicle, the deputies realized that the VIN number was still visible, and when they entered it into their system, it came back with a hit. The vehicle, a Mercury Cougar, had been reported stolen on February 17th, and it belonged to Kim George. No one could say for sure how long it had sat there, nor who may have burned it or why, but when the Boise Police Department were notified, they immediately sent officers to the scene. While it was a disturbing turn of events, it did have one positive result. Faced with this new evidence and the grim reality it suggested, the Boise Police Department officially opened an investigation into the disappearance of Jeremy Burt some 96 days after he was last seen. Investigators were left with only questions. Had Jeremy driven the vehicle to this remote desert location and burned it to cover his tracks? Or was someone covering up evidence of a more sinister crime? This concludes part one of the disappearance of Jeremy Burt. In part two, we'll get into the official investigation, suspicious actions by people associated with Jeremy, recorded conversations missing from his computer, his final debit card transactions, polygraph tests, an attempt to lure someone else to the Bruno Desert, and the possible link between Jeremy's disappearance and another unsolved missing persons case, that of Aaron Bernard, a man who Jeremy met through his relationship with Jeannie Braun. We'll examine the theories surrounding this case and discuss the possibilities of what may have led to Jeremy's mysterious disappearance 11 years ago. Thank you to everyone for listening and for being patient when I took last week off. This case has certainly sent me down the rabbit hole, so to speak, and while I'd love to have covered everything in a single episode, there's just far too much to condense into just one. If you think part one was bizarre, in part two, things get really strange. I want to give a special thank you to Patreon producers Lynn Merschel, Diane Dyson, Sarah Burrow, Krista Colvin, and Kate Alexander. Your support makes this podcast possible. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, visit patreon.com/traceevidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and you'll join me next week for the conclusion to this utterly disturbing and mystifying case on the next episode of Trace Evidence. I'm going to leave you with a promo for a podcast that I think you might enjoy as much as I do.
There are many true crime podcasts available, each offering a different perspective to the genre.
Each with their own niche that pulls the listener in by tugging at their heartstrings or their funny bone in one way or another.
What we aim to do with Status Pending is make you think. We want you to feel as though you're connected to the case. We want you to feel something.
The cases we're going to cover have discrepancies of some sort, and may or may not be well known.
They are either unsolved, prematurely closed, or open without any solid leads.
We want to get these stories out to the public, for the family, and for the victims.
Join us every month for a different case, which will be a different chapter in our podcast, as we take a three-part look into the facts.
We'll have interviews, expert opinions, and more. And we'll also be looking for suggestions from you for cases to take on as we move forward.
You can email us at statuspendingpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can subscribe to Status Pending wherever you listen to podcasts.